Chapter 4. A Retrovirus in Chronic Fatigue Syndrome. It's a classic gamma retrovirus, but it's totally new. Nobody's ever seen it before. Its closest relative is, in fact, from mice, and so we would call this a xenotropic retrovirus, because it's infecting a species other than mice. We've done it for many patients now, and we can say they're all independent infections. Dr. Joseph DeRisi, Hunting the Next Killer Virus, February 2006, Monterey, California, TED Talks. Incline Village, Nevada, summer and fall, 2006. The days in Nevada fell into an efficient routine. Mikovits saw an average of 5 to 6 of Peterson's patients a day at Sierra Internal Medicine. She and her team randomly numbered and entered every patient into the database to blind the clinical information they took next, and then they drew about 30 to 40 milliliters of blood. They separated and aliquoted, portioned, the blood into plasma, sera, and pellets for DNA analysis. After that, they mixed the samples with triazole, a chemical solution that preserved the nucleic acids and proteins when they were frozen. Triazole had been in use since 1987, and for many researchers it became the preferred method for RNA-DNA protein extraction. Even though triazole had an extremely potent and foul smell, Mikovits preferred it because it maintained RNA and protein integrity while ripping apart cells and cell components. One could feel comfortable going back to a sample preserved with triazole years and even decades later, and when it was unfrozen, one would see little, if any, degradation of the nucleic acids or proteins. To do longitudinal research on an epidemic such as ME/CFS, this meant that patients' blood could be captured like a snapshot in pathogenic time. In addition to preserving the samples in triazole, Mikovits's team would take some cells and preserve them in DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide, used as a cryoprotectant to prevent ice formation that would cause cell death, and place them in liquid nitrogen so they could be thawed at a later date for cell growth in cultures. Peterson's patients were scheduled to return to see him every 3 months, and this gave Mikovits the opportunity to collect more clinical data on each patient with additional blood. She hoped to eventually have 5 or 6 samples from each person as his or her symptoms waxed and waned, spanning seasonal patterns, life stresses, and additional variants. This was important in pathogen hunting, since it helped override the natural inclination of pathogens to evade detection, as well as providing samples to reproduce any results. In addition to taking the clinical information and placing samples in the new and improved repository, Mikovits had them tested for cytokines, cell signaling molecules that can create a disease fingerprint of sorts. Put them on the flow cytometer to determine types of immune cells, and looked at white blood cells under a microscope. Mikovits also used donations to purchase an expensive database also used in major hospitals like Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, the world's oldest and largest private cancer center. The database would track the master sample and then the aliquots, a portion of the original sample, that were utilized in every study. This allowed samples to be traced back to the exact aliquot from the master sample. Again, because preservation was everything, the master sample would remain untouched by anything that might contaminate it. Mikovits was determined that nobody would ever look at her repository and question its organization, as she had done when Byron Sue had led her to Peterson's original repository. It was like the Great Plague was moving from town to town, striking every 6 months, Paul Cheney later recalled. First, there was Lake Tahoe in 1984 and 1985, then the small town of Yerington, Nevada, 40 miles to the southeast, then 6 months after that, Placerville, California, 40 miles to the southwest. This new illness was a freak show of physical abnormalities, parading its strange, markedly odd symptoms along a slow route of quiet towns around Lake Tahoe and the Sierra Nevadas, near where the famous Donner Party met in 1846 with horrific catastrophe, including starvation, exposure, disease, hypothermia, and cannibalism, as they were cut off from both the East and the West. 11 years after these outbreaks, journalist Hillary Johnson published the definitive narrative of this modern calamity in a 700-plus page book called Osler's Web, Inside the Labyrinth of the Chronic Fatigue Epidemic. Johnson chronicled the government's lackluster, oftentimes nefarious, response to the then-emerging disease, beginning with a near day-by-day recounting of the outbreak in Incline Village, Nevada. Johnson's description of the extraordinary lengths to which Cheney and Peterson went to unravel the mysteries of the disease is worth revisiting because the doctors ultimately arrived, much like Mikovits 2 decades later, at a retroviral hypothesis. As Johnson reports, Peterson was a well-trained internal medicine specialist who set up a private practice in Incline Village after paying for his medical education by serving as a clinician to an impoverished population of migrants and farm workers in Idaho. Cheney, at the time, was nearing the end of his Air Force enlistment and serving as the chief of medicine at Mountain Home Air Force Base Hospital. After learning that Peterson was looking for a partner, Cheney decided to visit the Peterson Clinic for a week, discovered that he liked the picturesque area and the surprisingly sophisticated practice, and joined Peterson in October 1983. The exceptional natural beauty of the region was a given, and the economic opportunities were abundant, especially since Cheney and Peterson were the only two board-certified physicians in Lake Tahoe. The doctors ran what many locals considered the powerhouse practice in town, according to Johnson. Rapidly, they became the doctors of choice in the exclusive community where most people had the ability to see any doctor in the world. In October of 1984, however, Cheney and Peterson began to see an unusual group of patients, starting with the girls' basketball team of a local high school, several of whom complained of what seemed at first to be a severe case of mononucleosis. In March of 1985, Johnson writes, the doctors began to witness large numbers of adults coming down with similar complaints, including teachers who shared a faculty lounge. Most of these patients were in their 30s, which was atypical, as mono generally strikes adolescents and young adults, hence why it was nicknamed the kissing disease due to salivary transmission, though any contact with infected saliva can cause the disease. The numbers started to rise exponentially in May to June of 1985, and the two young physicians were astonished by what they saw. In a series of late-evening conversations, as described in Osler's Web, the two were forced to face the obvious. They were witnessing a very large epidemic among formerly healthy adults, with an average age of about 38 years old, occurring within a small geographical area. Initially, the disease resembled mononucleosis. Patients had sore throats, swollen glands, fever, large spleens that could be felt, and atypical lymphocytes. Lymphocytes are immune cells that fight foreign invaders, on peripheral smear tests. In 2013, Cheney recalled, some cases looked like classic mono, and in others somewhat different than mono. Something of an encephalitic onset, with severe pressure headaches, light sensitivity, disorientation, and vestibular problems. While Cheney observed that the cases would initially resemble the flu or mono, when the acute phase ended, there came this extraordinary fatigue, causing them to be unable to function, and in addition, lots of cognitive issues. Trouble with word search, finding their way through traffic in a one-horse town, forgetting things, having to take notes, not being able to watch TV programs or read books because they couldn't follow the plot. Eventually, Johnson continues, the doctors concluded that whatever had been in their patient's bloodstream had now invaded their brains. But what was it? Nothing in their medical training or clinical experience, Johnson noted, had prepared the doctors for anything like this devastating disease. A critical turning point in Johnson's narrative occurred when Cheney and Peterson sent their blood samples to Susan Wormsley, a biochemist and flow cytometry expert at Cytometrics Laboratory in San Diego. Flow cytometry quantifies and qualifies the condition of the immune system cells. Wormsley told Johnson, "Right from the time we separated and stained the cells, we saw a lot of debris," she said. "Just broken apart cells, pieces of cells, and platelets. And we don't see that in anything else that gets sent to us. Now, naturally, with everything that is sent to us, the people are sick, and most of them have cancer, leukemia, lymphoma, but we didn't see this kind of debris except in these patients." As Wormsley explained to Johnson, the answer was clear. Some type of virus or toxin had to be killing the cells of these patients. But there was another issue. In order to perform one of the tests, the Kappa-Lambda test, the researchers needed a good portion of B cells in their samples. "Right from the beginning," she tells Johnson, "these people seemed to have extremely low percentages of B cells, sometimes only 1 or 2% of their white blood cell population, instead of the 8 to 12% that we normally see. I noticed it because with a normal person, 10 milliliters of blood gives you plenty of cells to do the entire assay. But I wasn't able to get enough B cells to feel comfortable with Paul's patients." Another abnormality found in these unusual patients involved the ratio of T cell subsets, Johnson writes. T cells are an immune system cell which regulates production of disease-fighting antibodies. Scientists recognize two distinct types of T cells, helper T cells which boost antibody production, and suppressor cells which suppress antibody production. The ratio for a healthy person is one helper T cell to every two or three suppressor T cells. The helper cells are like new police recruits anxious for action, while the suppressor T cells are like the seasoned captains who would be more cautious in the use of force. With AIDS, HIV piggybacks onto the CD4 receptor on T cells and works its way into the cells, turning them into virus factories to reproduce itself and render the cells useless against infection. From Osler's web, "One of the most striking immunological aberrations Wormsley observed, however, was abnormal ratios of T cell subsets. T cells are a major category of immune system cell. They regulate production of disease-fighting antibodies. Two primary T cell subsets are helper and suppressor T cells, which boost and suppress antibody production, respectively. In AIDS, the normal ratio tends to be dramatically skewed in favor of suppressors. Since this finding is virtually diagnostic of AIDS, Cheney and Peterson were curious to know the T cell subset profile in the Tahoe malady. Wormsley's results showed that 4 of 5 Tahoe patients did have abnormal helper-suppressor ratios. but unlike the ratios in AIDS sufferers, they were low in the number of suppressor cells. Instead of 1 to 2 or 1 to 3, which are typical of healthy people, the incline patients had helper suppressor ratios of 5 to 1, 10 to 1, and higher. It was the mirror image of AIDS. Could there be a more frightening description of a disease? In AIDS, the immune system was told to essentially stand down, allowing all sorts of pathogens to run wild. By contrast, in ME/CFS, it seemed that the immune system was instructed to go into full attack mode, indiscriminately wiping out the good with the bad. The delicate balance of the immune system had been broken. Cheney and Peterson investigated whether this low suppressor, high helper T-cell ratio had been observed before and learned it was extremely rare. Peterson and Cheney began using the curious helper-suppressor ratio as yet another laboratory abnormality, in addition to the abnormal Epstein-Barr virus antibody profile, to support their diagnosis of the disease. It was a fragile stand, they knew, and they were uncertain of its significance. Yet it was real, and it was not normal. The elevated rate of another rare lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, MCL, increased Mikovits's curiosity about ME/CFS when she saw Peterson's presentation at the HHV6 conference in Barcelona, Spain. Mikovits would come to believe that the development of lymphomas represented a long-term progression and final outcome of the cellular damage wreaked by a retrovirus. The same idea had occurred to Cheney decades earlier, when HIV/AIDS was still a largely untreated pandemic. The saying, "If it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck," surely applied to what they were witnessing. Both of them could see a retroviral duck, one that quacked too loudly for a dissimilar decoy. Now they needed to find the location of the pond. Cheney wasted no time pursuing the retroviral hypothesis. The doctor knew that there was a commercial test for one other human retrovirus besides HIV, and that was HTLV-1, the human T-cell leukemia lymphoma virus 1, discovered by Frank Rossetti and Bernie Poise in Gallo's lab. Cheney sent 5 samples to a specialty lab in Los Angeles, Johnson writes, noting that the samples came from 5 patients who could not be classified as among the worst or the least affected, and 2 of them were teachers from the outbreak at an elementary school. The prevalence rate in the North American population for HTLV-1 was predicted to be about 0.031%, but 4 of the 5 samples, 80%, turned out to be positive. Cheney and Peterson thought they had landed their retrovirus. But as reported in Osler's Web, a second and a third test of the samples turned out negative, raising the possibility that their first results were false positives. Cheney was undeterred, certain he was on the trail of what caused the disease. One of his colleagues referred him to Dr. Elaine de Freitas of the Wistar Institute, the nation's first independent biomedical research facility, founded in Philadelphia in 1892. De Freitas was initially reluctant to enter into a new collaboration. During an interview with Johnson, she described her early interactions with Cheney. "What he was telling me about these patients was fascinating, and his theories and his experiments were very interesting. And he seemed absolutely convinced that there was a retrovirus involved in this. And I would tell him, 'I'm working on multiple sclerosis. I can only handle one disease at a time.' But he was so persistent. Finally, I decided that the quickest way of shutting him up was to take 5 or 6 patients, run the samples, to do what I could with them here. And they were all going to be negative, I was absolutely convinced of it. It took several months before Cheney heard back from DeFreitas. He learned that his samples had been passed along to the Gallo lab at the National Cancer Institute. Gallo's lab was puzzled because they had been finding antibodies to a new virus in a handful of different illnesses. When they got to Cheney's samples, they found all of them were infected by this new virus. The new virus was human herpes virus number 6, HHV6, and Gallo claimed its discovery in the journal Science on October 31, 1986. As mentioned before, HHV6 confused scientists for the next 20 years as to whether it caused disease or was just one more pathogen that appeared like wildfire in the system of these immune-compromised patients. It might be like the causative virus of Kaposi's sarcoma, human herpes virus 8, was discovered in men with HIV infections who also had KS, just as it previously had been found in the aging, dysfunctional immune systems of certain old men. HHV6 was the virus Mikovits would hear about in a yacht club in Southern California in 2006, forcing her to abruptly change course like a mariner heading into a perfect storm. Paul Cheney first met Judy Mikovits on a mountaintop Buddhist retreat about 2.5 hours north of San Francisco. Nestled in the California wine country, the Ratna Ling, Buddhist for health, retreat center is located on 120 acres of redwood forests in the coastal range, about a mile away from the Pacific Ocean. Among the towering redwoods and fog-shrouded ridges of Sonoma County, Ratna Ling plays host several times a year to a unique gathering of scientists and medical researchers. The driving force behind this series of ongoing conferences under the gorgeous post and beam space of Ratna Ling was a wealthy San Francisco businessman who converted to Tibetan Buddhism and then poured money into this small health retreat. When his wife came down with ME/CFS, he formed a consortium of the best minds in related medical and research fields and invited them to Ratna Ling. As a business big shot who had created a successful algorithm for the world's economy, his guiding principle was to get smart people with diverse ideas into the same room and let those ideas percolate. Cheney recalled, "The first conference was 30 people, and it was one of the greatest intellectual experiences of my life. I got to see in front of me all the best thinking in one room. It was very collegial. It was a Buddhist temple. You had to take your shoes off, and we ate vegetarian meals. There were no cell phones, televisions, radios, or anything. Each of us presented for about 20 minutes. Then people around the room would make comments and have a discussion. It was very respectful of other views, even if they were the exact opposite of yours. And I learned a lot. I became comfortable with certain aspects of what I believed and saw flaws in my own thinking. It was wonderful." This was repeated every few months. The next one was on Lyme disease, the one after that was autism, and then there was one on autoimmunity. If you were invited to any single conference, you could attend any of the other ones. I attended the one on chronic fatigue syndrome and the one on autism because I had findings on autism to share. Judy spoke at the Chronic Fatigue Syndrome conference, and that's where I met her. Cheney went on to say he was respectful of Mikovits's passion, intelligence, and knowledge of the field. They would continue to stay in touch, and he would be one of the first people Mikovits would tell when something very exciting had been found in the disease which he had studied for so long. At the Ratna Ling conference on chronic fatigue syndrome, Cheney also met Dr. Joseph Burascano, a prominent Lyme disease expert who co-authored the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, ILADS, guidelines for treatment and diagnosis of Lyme and related co-infections. Cheney rapidly bonded with Burascano, respecting the physician's intellect as well as his passionate but even temperament. Burascano told Cheney that he had treated acute Lyme disease on Long Island, where the disease is highly endemic, for a decade between 1970 and 1980. The patients presented with the standard known tick bite, bullseye rash, and acute illness that resolved with the medication doxycycline. Not one of these cases advanced into chronic Lyme disease in those days. But around 1980, something changed in his practice. Patients started getting a new disease, a chronic Lyme disease that did not go away. It reminded Cheney of a time in 1987 when he attended a conference in Portland, Oregon, with about 15 other clinicians treating ME/CFS patients. The moderator asked the clinicians to raise hands to note the year when they first began to see large numbers of ME/CFS cases in their practices. The moderator called out 1978, and nobody raised a hand. The same thing with 1979, not one hand. For 1980, two hands popped up. One was from a clinician in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the other was from New York City, the two areas that were the epicenters of the AIDS epidemic. This revelation made Cheney think more deeply about the pathogenesis of ME/CFS. What did it mean that San Francisco and New York City presented with the first increases in these illnesses? Aside from high rents, coastal proximity, international airports, large, diverse emigre populations, and foodie cuisine, what did these two cities have in common? It was mysterious. Most viruses strike the young or the old, but whatever was at the heart of this disease was striking those in adolescence and early adulthood. Few over 50 years of age came down with it, and it certainly wasn't rampaging through nursing homes. Kids in elementary schools were not sneezing on each other's milk cartons and causing large outbreaks in their schools. Whatever was initiating the problem seemed to require a robust immune system to counterattack it, which was similar to the profile of those struck down by mononucleosis, caused by the herpes virus, Epstein-Barr. Hence, perhaps they were witnessing a herpes virus, or the destruction of an otherwise intact adult immunity. Cheney felt it was likely that ME/CFS was an epiphenomenon of the AIDS epidemic. He considered HHV6 type A a likely causative candidate, but also thought HHV6A may have recombined to some degree with the HIV retrovirus. Both HHV6A and HIV could readily infect the same type of cell. Cheney was also intrigued by a paper he read from Dr. Patricia Coyle of the State University of New York at Stony Brook, in which she compared many of the features of chronic Lyme disease and ME/CFS and found that a large number of the clinical markers of the two were indistinguishable. Many autism doctors later asserted that Lyme played a significant role in autism, and Cheney soon saw an overlap of both of these conditions with ME/CFS. In February of 2011, however, Dr. Stephen E. Schultzer's research team of New Jersey, along with Dr. Richard D. Smith of the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, published in the journal PLOS-1 that chronic Lyme disease, which they called neurologic post-treatment Lyme disease, and ME/CFS patients presented with unique, measurable proteins in their spinal fluids, different from each other and different from controls. Was it possible, then, that Lyme, caused by a spirochete, was not unlike syphilis, caused by a spirochete, in untreated AIDS, a co-infection that furthered the retroviral damage? Of what transpired with Mikovits and the controversy over XMRV, Cheney would say, I truly do believe with the results she got from the spleen focus forming virus antibody test, designed to detect known and undiscovered mouse xenotropic retroviruses, that there's something there. We just don't know what it is. I suppose it's possible that it's a human endogenous retrovirus that's active, making an envelope protein and a gag protein. It could be a novel gamma retrovirus, yet to be discovered. It could be a piece of HIV stuck in a herpes virus, making it a cross between a retrovirus and a herpes virus. The most likely virus for that would be HHV6, since it integrates into the human DNA, just like retroviruses do. So we could have a cross of some kind. I don't know what this is, Cheney said, but I sure as hell know what this disease is. It's very coherent. You can measure it by objective standards that are not found in control groups and cannot be explained by normal medicine. Even before Annette Whittemore met Mikovits, she was interested in Dr. Joseph DeRisi's invention called the Virochip, which had first identified XMRV in the tumors of prostate cancer patients in 2006 for the ME/CFS patients, including her daughter. The Virochip was a single diagnostic assay that contained a genetic sequence for every known virus, and that also had the ability to identify novel viruses. It had evolved out of a marriage of virology and technology, and was expected to more rapidly advance the science of viral detection. DeRisi had discovered XMRV along with Dr. Robert Silverman of the prestigious Cleveland Clinic, who would later come to play a crucial role in their work. Annette told Judy she had written a letter to DeRisi inquiring about using the chip, but she never received a reply. After Mikovits started working with Peterson, Mikovits revived the Virochip idea, but the two groups were unable to come to an agreement. At the National Cancer Institute, there was a similar chip developed by the Molecular Technologies Program. Rossetti had access to it, and the NCI was fortuitously looking for investigators willing to try it. This option seemed like a good opportunity, but one the research team would later come to regret. There were entire virus families that were not represented on the chip, including some in the XMRV family. A retrovirus virus might have something like 9,000 base nucleotide pairs in its genetic makeup, some of which were quickly evolving and others which were not. Among animals, even small genetic variations create wildly different species. For example, a human and a chimp vary in their genetic makeup by approximately 2%. But nobody would ever identify them as the same species. However, an RNA virus can vary in its genetic makeup by a much greater percentage and still be considered the same species. The different subtypes of HIV differ by 25 to 30%, while the viruses in a specific subtype themselves can typically differ by 10 to 15%. A typical assay might have only 50 to 200 base nucleotide pairs in its sequence to determine the identity of a certain virus. It was therefore critical in creating an accurate assay to determine which stretches of the viral genome were not evolving, or, in the parlance of virologists, which were conserved. About a year after they settled on the NCI chip that first summer of 2006, Mikovits did some additional research, talking with Dr. Ian Lipkin, the head of Columbia University's Institute of Infection and Immunity. Lipkin thought that both the NCI and DeRisi chips were flawed. Lipkin articulated at length about the technology he had developed and why it was better than either chip. Even though Mikovits did not understand every technical detail, she was able to discern that Lipkin did indeed have the superior technology. But their experiments were already well underway, and it would have been unethical for Lipkin to intervene in the research at such a time. In retrospect, Mikovits wished she had learned about Lipkin's technology before she used the NCI chip with Peterson's top 70 samples and as a component of the Integrative Neural Immune Programs, INIP, Intramural Research Award investigation. This knowledge might have radically altered the course of events. Dr. Dennis Taub and Frank Rossetti co-wrote a grant proposal for the INIP program, looking at the role of chronic inflammation stimulation by an active herpes virus infection, and what role this might have in the development of immune dysfunction and mantle cell lymphoma in ME/CFS patients. The work would be done with the samples Mikovits had prepared for Peterson the summer of 2006. The proposal was awarded 3 years of funding in September of 2007, 6 months before she would discuss chip technology with Lipkin. Less than a year since Mikovits set forth her plan, a new era of research into ME/CFS was barreling ahead. As Mikovits worked on building a program to unravel the mystery of ME/CFS, she became acutely aware of the influence wielded by the Whittemores in Nevada. In the fall of 2006, the Whittemores threw a themed "I Hope You Dance" fundraiser, since few ME/CFS patients could dance anymore, at the Peppermill Casino in Reno, a coffee shop turned gaming center when the owners partnered with the Sino family in 1979. The event featured the legendary singer Joan Baez. The event was populated by Nevada royalty, most of the state's congressional delegation, the current and former governor of Nevada, and U.S. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, with his wife and four sons. Senator Reid received a special award for his support of the Institute, and Joan Baez gave him an autographed guitar from her collection. Future honorees included Governor Kenny Gwynn, State Senator Bill Raggio, and Ron Perigiri, who would be appointed Nevada Supreme Court Chief Justice in 2010. In late fall of 2007, Mikovits organized the WPI's first scientific retreat hosted by the Whittemores at Red Hawk for a number of notable scientists in the field, including Drs. Nancy Klimas and Suzanne Vernon, as well as others from the UNR, many of whom possessed appropriate skill sets to figure out how to attack this problem. The group included immunologists, virologists, microbiologists, and any other field that Mikovits felt might conceivably be able to offer some assistance. Afterward, everybody drove out to the Whittemores' lakeshore house. There, at Glenbrook, Mikovits was first formally introduced to Harry Reid, who seemed to be an unpretentious man. He didn't overpower a room the way Harvey did, and it wasn't just because Harvey towered over the senator in height. Mikovits was not interested in politics. Her husband David did like rousing conversation about politics and history, and thus was thrilled to engage with the senator. Over the years that Mikovits worked in Nevada, the Reeds were a common fixture at Whittemore events. In 2005, prior to the arrival of Mikovits, the Whittemores had persuaded the Nevada legislature to unanimously pass Senate Bill 105, which appropriated $10 million to the University of Nevada School of Medicine, the Nevada Cancer Institute, and the Whittemore Peterson Institute. Harvey pledged to contribute $2 million to this effort, as well as raise an additional $2 million from friends and associates. These donations comprised the initial seed money for what would later become the Center for Molecular Medicine at UNR to house the WPI. In 2007, Mikovits joined Harvey and Annette in advocating for and securing passage of Senate Bill 443, which set aside $2 million for the construction of a facility dedicated to the research and treatment of neuroimmune disorders, as well as providing money for equipment and furnishings. The legislature also provided funds for continued operational funding for the WPI in their legislation. On January 14, 2008, Annette Whittemore wrote a glowing letter to Mikovits on what had transpired in the past year and a half, noting that Judy had taken the program from a small one-room office to a first-class research laboratory. Annette's tone belied her genuine warmth for her friend and colleague, and, as she would have put it, her new family member. Mikovits also received a check for $20,000, her annual bonus. She felt she had earned every penny of it. Another intriguing clue to unraveling the riddle of ME/CFS came in a paper published in 2005 by Belgian researcher Dr. Kenny de Merler. De Merler reported that the RNase L enzyme in ME/CFS patients wasn't working effectively. This meant that patients would have a reduced ability to defend against an RNA virus or retrovirus. It was a simple yet crippling defect in the immune system. Mikovits and her team worked in 2007 and 2008 on developing tests to monitor cytokine and chemokine, a family of small cytokines, levels of the patients. Unlike in HIV, T cells from ME/CFS patients were not dying in culture. It was more like HTLV-1, which could be latent in T cells for decades without killing them and still cause a neurological disease, HTLV-1 associated myelopathy tropical spastic paraparesis, HAM/TSP. Only rarely, less than 5% of the cases, did HTLV-1 infection transform the T cells, causing leukemia or result in HAM/TSP. Now they had found two ways in which ME/CFS patients' immune systems were dysregulated similar to patients with HAM/TSP: the dysfunction of Resetti's plasmacytoid dendritic cells and the inflammatory cytokine signatures. Her perspective began to solidify in October of 2007, when she and a postdoctoral researcher who had recently graduated from the UNR, Dr. Vincent Lombardi, attended the Michael Milken prostate cancer meeting in Incline Village. Lombardi had already received a $50,000 grant to study RNase L and prostate cancer from the Nevada Cancer Institute. At the Milken meeting in October 2007, he first met Robert Silverman of the Cleveland Clinic, the scientist who is credited with discovering XMRV in prostate cancer cells, and discussed the research with him. In March of 2008, Silverman sent him some reagents, including the plasmid containing XMRV clone, to test his material. Mikovits had helped Lombardi with some of the design of his experiments for the prostate cancer grant, but they had been so busy working on ME/CFS that Lombardi hadn't actually been able to get caught up and do the work. Silverman's reagents sat in the freezer for close to 6 months. Mikovits was familiar with Silverman, as they had both worked in prostate cancer research and also attended meetings of the American Association of Cancer Researcher prostate cancer meetings. He was an immunologist with an expertise in the type 1 interferon pathway in cancer. Silverman's poster presentation at the Milken event was on the RNase-L genetic defects in prostate cancer patients who tested positive for the newly discovered XMRV retrovirus. Mikovits attended the conference, displaying a poster on behalf of the biotech company for whom she had consulted, showing how their drugs affected inflammation and cytokine signatures of disease. They had some early research on how these drugs worked on ME/CFS patients not shown on the poster, but was the topic of their private conversations. Little interest was displayed in Silverman's and Mikovits's posters, so the two of them, along with Lombardi, had some time to talk then, and she just happened to be displaying her poster next to Silverman's. It was a fortuitous collision of thinking. A quick perusal of the two posters showed some intriguing similarities. Mikovits's work showed high levels of pro-inflammatory cytokines and chemokines, such as IL-6, chemokine IL-8, and they showed dysregulation on interferon alpha. Mikovits, Silverman, and Lombardi were all intrigued by the abnormalities in RNase-L pathway, because it might explain why the patients had so many chronic viral infections. Maybe they were dealing with a retrovirus that had some similarities to HIV and HTLV-1. Could Silverman's XMRV explain the differing results? Mikovits was somewhat skeptical that Silverman's reagents would find this newly discovered retrovirus in her patient population. Mikovits recalled that the microarray was showing an elevated expression of just about every virus, as if something had thrown the immune system out of control. But the subjects weren't obviously dying like AIDS patients, and aside from the increased incidence of certain types of lymphomas, they weren't developing cancer, although Hillary Johnson had documented other cancers, such as salivary gland cancers, in the patient populations elsewhere. When they got back to their lab, Mikovits and Lombardi instructed a new graduate student, Max Post, to do some PCR testing using Silverman's reagents. Mikovits had a dual role at the WPI, also serving as an adjunct professor in several departments at UNR, working extensively with students and teaching them the proper and thorough way to do a scientific investigation so that they would come away with foundational knowledge. Max Post would go on to become one of Mikovits's closest colleagues, and they would develop almost a mother-son type relationship. Post was not quite cut from the same cloth as many of the other graduate students, sporting bike racing tattoos on his right arm, along with a quote in Latin from the 1980s film American Flyers, which read, Res firma metescri nescit, or A firm resolve is not easily broken. On Max's left arm, the subject was science. He had illustrations of DNA proteins being translated, immune cells, B cells, antibodies being secreted, and veins with viruses exploding out of them. When the debates between Mikovits and Coffin over XMRV became heated, Max had a small coffin tattooed on his middle right finger, so that if he ever met Coffin and went to shake his hand, the veteran researcher would know just what Max thought of him. When Mikovits worked with Max, they picked out samples from 20 of the sickest patients, including several diagnosed with lymphoma, and she asked him to do PCR on the samples. Most of the samples came back negative, but two or three were positive. However, the bands were the wrong sizes, meaning there could possibly be a related virus. If she had been at a typical lab with a well-trained staff, she might have simply thrown those samples out, figuring something went wrong in the experiment. She might have returned to the cytokines, chemokines, RNase-L, natural killer cells, or something else entirely, and conclude that there was not a novel virus in the samples. But because she was teaching a young researcher, she followed the most rigorous practices and asked Max to sequence the bands. Another nagging doubt in her mind was that some of the bands were quite bright, a strong positive signal. When the results came back, they contained sequences of Silverman's XMRV retrovirus. There were some deletions at curious places and other inconsistencies, but if one aligned the sequences in just a certain way, the pattern looked like XMRV GAG, that is, sequences translated into a structural protein of XMRV. GAG polyproteins are used in the viral replication cycle of a retrovirus. It was like a Christmas tree lighting up. Mikovits showed Post how to optimize the PCR, how to ever so slightly vary the annealing temperature so that he could find everything that was closely related. Mikovits was not looking for a stringent match, but more of a loose association that might suggest they were looking at a taxonomic family member to XMRV. Lowering the stringency of the PCR changed everything. They found a lot of samples in the group of 20 ME/CFS patients with sequences highly similar to XMRV GAG. They pulled an additional 30 samples and tested them under the loosened PCR standard. A number of those were positive as well. They tested samples that had been taken at different intervals from a single individual. In doing this, they frequently found patients who tested negative in one sample, but positive in another. Both viral latency and methylation issues could, at least temporarily, conceal the presence of a virus from PCR tests. This interesting implication that ME/CFS patients could be positive for XMRV was something they felt compelled to discuss with Silverman and Rossetti. She hoped she could convince Frank to come for a holiday in San Diego and show him the preliminary data. If Rossetti thought the preliminary data was compelling, they had a green light. They met in January of 2009 in San Diego during a meeting of the American Association of Cancer Research, AACR, Special Focus Prostate Cancer Meeting, first to sign a confidential disclosure agreement regarding XMRV and the recent data generated by Post and Lombardi in the Mikovits lab. After signing the agreement, Lombardi and Mikovits showed the preliminary data to Silverman and Rossetti to see if the two experts felt the data warranted a collaboration. The four of them, Mikovits, Rossetti, Lombardi, and Silverman, agreed early on to authorship of the paper. Lombardi would be first author and Mikovits would be senior author, as is customary for a postdoctoral fellow developing the mentor's research hypothesis under her direction. The agreement they ended up signing on January 20th stated that the Cleveland Clinic had novel assays to detect xenotropic murine leukemia virus-related virus, XMRV, infections in humans, and that both the National Cancer Institute and the Whittemore-Peterson Institute had certain confidential information relating to detection of XMRV in patients with chronic fatigue syndrome. The esteemed Cleveland Clinic, the iconic NCI, and the still formative WPI, which did not yet have a building, just a borrowed lab, were going to commence a pivotal study on whether the XMRV virus was associated with ME/CFS. It had been a wild 2.5-year ride for Mikovits. Now she and her colleagues were on a virology big game hunt. They were on the hunt for a retrovirus.